Support for Need to Know comes from the Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovation in education, democratic engagement, and the advancement of international peace and security. Learn more at carnegie.org. Welcome to the Need to Know podcast from the Wilson Center, a podcast for policymakers available to everyone. Always informative, nonpartisan, and relevant, we go beyond the headlines to understand the trend lines in foreign policy. Welcome back to the Need to Know podcast. I'm your host, John Molesky. Now, regular listeners will have noticed that I am not the Need to Know host you've come to know and love. That would be our friend and former colleague, Aaron Jones. And I know many of you will be disappointed to learn that Aaron has left the Wilson Center and will now be sharing his considerable talents with the Committee for a Responsible Federal Government. Aaron is the creator of this podcast. He not only produced and hosted Need to Know, but Renaissance man that he is, Aaron actually composed the music you hear at the open and close of each episode. Speaking of which, there have been more than 100 episodes of Need to Know with Aaron's departure. The reins to the program have been passed to Sharana Harris, and who will be doing the producing, editing, among other things, and I'll be handling the hosting duties. And together, we're not only grateful for what Aaron has created, but we'll also attempt to do justice to the legacy he's left us with. And with that, let's get to this episode's guests. I'm thrilled to begin my term as Need to Know host with two remarkable people. Hale Esfandiari is a Wilson Center Distinguished Fellow and Director Emerita of the Center's Middle East Program. And Marina Ottaway is a Middle East Program Fellow and the former head of the Middle East Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Great to see both of you again. Welcome to the Need to Know podcast. So today, our guests are going to help us understand the current wave of protests in Iran. And I think in maybe it was in the joint article that both of you just wrote that was published by the Wilson Center. I think that where I read that the history of these protests, not just in Iran, but in the Middle East, has been high hopes followed by disappointment. Is that what we're looking at again? Hale, we can begin with you and then we'll go to Marina.
Okay. In the case of Iran, definitely, and I suppose in the case of the rest of the Middle East countries of the Arab Spring also, Marina will cover that. I will focus on Iran. Look, Iran had its success in 1979 when you had the Islamic Revolution. Don't forget that, because the country voted with its feet and on the ballot box to overthrow the monarchy and have an Islamic Republic. But it didn't take long to be totally disappointed with what the Islamic Republic was going to offer. But the demonstrations leading to the overthrow of the monarchy and the revolution took a whole year. It didn't happen in 1 week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks. Interestingly enough, today is the 40th day of the death, of the murder, better said, of Mahsa Amini, the young Kurdish girl.
25-year-old.
Yeah, who showed a little bit of hair and was arrested, and she was killed. And in this, taking you back to 1979, there was a death in the city of Tabriz. And on the 40th anniversary, there were lots of protests. And that is how the protest movement started. Mm-hmm. And a year later, the regime was overthrown.
And Masha was wearing a hijab, just not correctly.
Of course.
Correct?
Of course.
I mean, if the morality replaced.
She showed some hair.
Yeah. And that was the great crime that cost her life.
Yeah. I mean, everything else has been settled and solved in Iran, and all is left is the little bit of hair to trigger the last 6 weeks, what has been going on. The number of deaths are almost. Now, today, the latest figures were 234. Mm. People have been killed, among them 29 children. And this is the first time, John, Marina, that in the life of the Islamic Republic, and before that, that the security police and forces are even shooting at children.
So, Marina, this... sorry, Holly, I didn't mean to step on your last thought there. So, Marina, this momentum of people either on the inside and the outside get their hopes up, but then it doesn't really gain traction. Is that what you're looking at now? Do you see the same signs?
I share Halep's pessimism about the outcome here. I have done some work on the Arab protest movements. And I also went back to look somewhat superficially at the greater revolutions. When do they succeed and when do they fail? And I think the answer is always the same. It is if there is organizations behind the movement. In other words, the spontaneity of the movements, which is in many ways their strength and what makes them so appealing. I mean, you look at these young kids taking to the streets and you want them to succeed. But the fact is that the evidence shows that unless there is an organization behind it.
So like the labor unions in Tunisia.
The labor unions in Tunisia. Khomeini and in the Islamic Revolution back there. Lenin and the Communist Party in Russia. The Communist Party in China. I mean, there was a huge amount of organizing, which is unfortunately the reason why usually revolution lead to authoritarian regimes, because you have these strong organizations taking over
and somebody to negotiate with.
Yeah.
So these current round of protests continue even without leadership. Is there an opportunity for leadership to emerge?
It's too soon to say whether there will be a leadership from inside Iran or outside Iran. Because if it is inside Iran, they will be arrested immediately, put in jail if they are lucky, you know, and executed, which probably would happen. But outside Iran, you see voices. But it's too soon, you know, 6 weeks later, after this, it's a bit too soon to see who is going to be the leader. As Marina said, during the Islamic Revolution, it was not only Ayatollah Khomeini sitting in Iraq and sending out tapes and, you know, telling people what to do, but you had the network of mosques all over Iran and clergy in every little village in Iran. There was a local cleric. There was a local mullah sitting there who was listening to what was told to him by the central government, not the government, but the main mosques in Tehran.
So while there's no leader, no official leader, or no organizing institution or organization, this is different in that it is, at least informally, being instigated or led by women. Does that give you any hope for a different outcome, or does that change the calculus in any meaningful way?
I don't think it does. I mean, I find it very encouraging to see these women taking her destiny in their own hands. But in terms of the chances of a movement without a structure and without leadership succeeding, I think the fact that they are women does not make much a difference. You see, there are two reasons why this movement and the movements in the Arab countries, the Arab uprisings, had no leadership. One was philosophical, that there is many young people being philosophically opposed to the idea of hierarchies. We are not going to create an organization. That's our parents' thing. We don't do things that way. And the second one is expediency. That is the fact that it's much easier for a government to destroy a hierarchical organization than to destroy a network because you don't know where to start. And so both arguments essentially go against the emergence of a structure and the emergence of leadership. Unless, as Halle said, it comes from the outside. But I don't know enough about the exiled movements, because often exiled movements are totally out of touch.
Conventional wisdom says countries don't change from the outside, they change from the inside.
Well, Khomeini is a bit different.
I mean, outside of an actual invasion or occupation.
Yeah, you're right. But you know, what makes it different this time. And look, it has lasted 6 weeks. It's not 10 days or 2 weeks and so on. Is that you have a generation. You have a generation known as the Gen Z, you know. Now they are referred even in Persian to them as Gen Z. That is not afraid of getting killed. And this is, for me, this is really baffling that a young person goes out night after night knowing that she or he may not return home. And they do that because it shows how sick and tired they are, you know, with the regime. But there is no organization, but, you know, there are professional groups. I was talking to Marina yesterday and telling her, for example, a small labor union, which is relatively powerful. They have come out in support of these of the young protesters, you know. There are the union of medical doctors, for example, 800 doctors signed a letter asking the government stop killing them and so on. So whether at some stage we will see this leading to strikes, whether we will see a crack in the revolutionary guard, which will then change the whole atmosphere, even, you know, on the streets. We haven't reached that point, and it's a question mark.
Is it clear at this point what the protesters are asking for? One thing would be a loosening of these rules that the so-called, what is the term for the police who made the arrests? Morality police. So far, that a loosening of those rules, is there something more specific, or is this a case, because we don't have leadership, that there are not a clear set of demands?
Well, The demands kind of balloon, because they started, you know, a protest having to against the hijab. But it's much more, and they end up by being protest against the regime in general. But also that makes it very difficult for these groups to be able to claim a victory. And the government, I must say, it's proving very, very unyielding. Let me give you an example. The regime in Saudi Arabia is extremely authoritarian. But one thing that Mohammed bin Salman discovered is that it pays in terms of popularity and support.
To allow people to go to the movies.
And to put...
Or to women tell, to drive.
And to tell the morality police. They also had a morality police to take them off the street. In fact, the morality police is rather depressed.
That raises the question why this regime is so adamant in holding the line. Are they afraid that once they begin, once the genie is out of the bottle, so to speak, that it creates a momentum that they can't stop?
Precisely, John. Don't forget, Mohammed bin Salman has been there only a decade or a bit more to do these things. The Islamic Republic was there for 40 years. And from the very beginning, you know, they focused on pushing women to become a second-class citizen and to control. This was it. And control in both in the social way, in legal way, and also in political way. So there is no room for these young people to breathe. Not even going to sit in a coffee shop to have a cup of coffee together without worrying that the morality police comes after them. But also, every time you had a president who is slightly more moderate, like Khatami was, they would leave the people alone, you know. But this current president, I mean, reintroduce the morality police with a vengeance on the streets, and this is the result.
Yeah. There is a difference in generation, I think, which is important. I mean, Mohammed bin Salman is 35?
A young man.
36, whatever. And he understands, I mean, I'm not an admirer of him, but no. I understand, he understands that what is important to him is what? Holding on to power. He's the Minister of Defense. He has, he's the Prime Minister now. He has everything in his hands. Let the kids go to the movies. And in fact, that does not do any harm to his power. Let them not mingle in public. That's not going to undermine his power. And in fact, he has gained power by doing this.
Yeah, you mentioned it's popular.
He's popular.
And even within a totalitarian society, popularity
that
is
helps.
A useful,
that helps.
A useful tool.
But look, he has also put women activists in jail and given them long sentences. So it's
well, that's your point. You don't admire him. We don't want to go too far.
Because everything has to come from him. The women activists were undermining his power. The kids who want to go to the movies are not.
So, you know, part of the Need to Know podcast, as it is marketed to people on the Hill, both members of Congress and their staffs, giving them useful information. So put your policy-making hat on. If you're giving advice to the U.S. Congress or any policy bodies around the world who want to help those in the country who would like to protest against these draconian measures, what can you do from the outside? What are the policies that would be most effective that won't perhaps make the situation work by causing the regime to push back?
Well, let me...
I know it's a tough question.
Let me have a stab of it. I think it's more a question of what you don't do than what you do.
Yeah.
In other words, yes, it's all right to say, we support your goals, we support you, but you also have to be very careful that at some point you end up by sounding ridiculous because people become very cynical. Yes, we
are a paper tiger.
But how?
Set yourself up to become a paper tiger.
What are you doing? But I think one of the most important things in all these cases is for the U.S. or anybody else not to embrace a specific person and try to make the... It's easier in this case because it's not clear who the specific person would be, but it would be very dangerous to embrace anybody as an example of the reformer that we want to take over in that case.
Well, like the woman here at the table with us who was accused of trying to lead a velvet revolution when you were visiting your mother and ended up in prison.
That's right. But, John, I think in this case, the case of Iran, two things are very important. First of all, if the protest movement had not started with women, with the leadership of women, the outside world would have not been interested. And this is the first time in all these 40 years when you have had a protest movement in Iran that you had such an international support. Mm-hmm. So therefore, I think there is certain things that one can do. I mean, to bring pressure on the government. You know, for example, they have started putting these protesters on trial. The first trial was today. Trying to delegitimize these trials is very important, you know, by the outside world. Because inside Iran, you can't write anything because of the censorship. Delegitimizing these trials and insisting that all the arrestees, all these people who are sitting in jail should be released. You have kids of 9-year-old kids sitting in jail. I mean, this is absurd. You know, they now go into elementary schools and arrest children. So this is the kind of thing that the outside world can do. Plus, I mean, one step even further is for the European, I think, to just withdraw their ambassadors and for a while. There is a precedence for that. When Iran had the fatwa against Salman Rushdie, the European pulled out. Not for too long, but, it is just bringing pressure on the government. And this is not interfering. You know, it is the reaction that the
statement of
that
values
that the West can bring in. It's not interference, you know.
It's a moral position.
Yeah.
I mean, whether or not it really has an impact, that's a different issue. But it's certainly a moral position.
I mentioned Halle's ordeal, and I should mention her book for people who are interested. My Prison, My Home, a fantastic description of everything that you went through and a lot of lessons to be learned from it. And Marina, I also want to mention you and your other half. Notice I didn't say better half.
I am the better half.
That's right. You and David Ottaway are working on a book about these things, right? About the whole larger picture in the Middle East.
Well, the book is out.
Oh, it's out. Okay. listen to me. I meant, so, and what's the title? I have it in my notes, but you can find it quicker than me.
Of four words.
There you go.
The Middle East.
Arab regions after the uprisings. Yeah. Terrific. Another book I want to recommend, even though I'm behind, obviously, in talking about
Well,
it.
At least it's out.
Which is always good news for an author. So anything we haven't covered before we say goodbye on this episode, is there anything important that we haven't discussed that you think it's important for people to need to know? To
I think maybe Marina can say two, three sentences about why. Take the example of Tunisia and also Egypt. Why it failed?
Well, Tunisia succeeded originally because the labor union threw their weight behind the uprising. I mean, everybody talks about the history of the fruit vendor who immolated himself.
Yes.
It was the third case of immolation in a few weeks. This was had become, unfortunately, a common form of protest. And the other ones got, you know, two lines in the newspapers and nothing happened. And what you had instead in this particular case, the local teachers' union threw its weight behind it. And then the entire labor union organization came on behind it. So that's a clear example of where there was an organization. Now the case is slipping. The Tunisian democracy is quickly grinding to a halt. The labor unions are not participating. They have sat on the sideline, so there is not that element of organization. In Egypt, you had two organized forces in Egypt, and they're the ones who decided what happened. One organized force was the military. That was always there behind the scenes and held the real power. But the military originally decided to play nice and to play democratic. And they allowed elections to take place. And who won? The best organized force, civilian force in the country, the Muslim Brotherhood. The other political parties were not organized. So it always goes back to the issue of organization.
Yeah, the lesson seems clear.
And being able to muster people for whatever you are trying to do.
Maybe that'll be the next stage, right? We'll keep hope alive.
Yes.
Halle Esfandiary, Marina Ottaway, thank you very much for joining us. We want to tell our listeners that if you enjoyed the information you got today, that plenty more where that came from at wilsoncenter.org and also other podcasts from the Wilson Center. You'll be able to find reliable, fact-based, nonpartisan information on topics of international importance. And that's what we'll continue to bring you here on Need to Know. And thanks for getting us off to a great start in the new generation, the new iteration of Need to Know. Until next time, I want to say to our listeners, thanks for joining us. We'll see you again.